So at the end of Genesis 15, which is what we went over last week, what happened was Abraham was once again doubting God because God has made this great promise to him that he's going to be the father of many nations, that he's going to give Abraham and his descendants the land of Canaan, which is modern-day Israel. He's given them all these amazing promises, but Abraham at this point is closing in on the 90s. He hasn't had any kids yet, and so he's starting to naturally doubt. He's like, you know, how am I going to be the father of many nations when I don't even have one kid? And so God, what he did in chapter 15 is he sat down with Abraham and he says, what can I do with you that you'll trust me? And Abraham says, man, like, I don't know. And God says, you know what? Let's make a covenant. So Abraham got out these animals and he cut them in half, which is pretty gory and kind of gross. And what that was to signify was that when two people in those days, when they wanted to make a promise to one another, when they really wanted to say, we are dedicated to one another no matter what happens, this is what they would do. They would sacrifice animals, split them in two, and they would walk between them. And when you're doing that, you're acting out a covenant. You're saying, if either of us break this agreement, then let us be like these animals. Let us be sawn in half. Let us be destroyed as a result of destroying our promise. And Abraham was supposed to do this with God, but he fell asleep. He didn't make it. He wasn't a night owl, so he passes out. God shows up, and God walked down the aisle alone. And this, what we see in Genesis 15 is we see the gospel, that mankind can never be faithful to God. We could never live up to God's standards for us, but that's okay because God makes that covenant with us anyway. He makes the promise anyway. And when God was walking down the aisle, he said, if I break this covenant, even if you don't break the covenant, Abraham, if I break this covenant, let me be sawed in half, let my life turn to death, let everything I have be destroyed. And he made that promise with Abraham. And he made that promise with Abraham knowing that Abraham still wouldn't live up to the covenant and that God would have to be cut in half anyway. Right? And that's what we call the gospel. That's what happened to Christ. For our unfaithfulness to the covenant of God, God himself was killed for us. So God made this tremendous, amazing promise to Abraham. And you'd think like, man, Abraham certainly is going to be faithful to the rest of his days now, right? I mean, what greater way could God demonstrate his faithfulness than that? Well, Genesis 16 says this. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, see now the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my handmaid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, so he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Then Sarai said to Abram, my wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and you. So Abram said to Sarai, indeed, your maid is in your hands. Do to her as you please. And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. So right off the bat, before we get into the story, I've mentioned this a couple times as we're going through the book of Genesis. A lot of times when we go to church for a while, we go to Sunday school, we get this wrong idea from the Bible that the people who are mentioned in the Bible are always doing the right thing. You know, that everything that they're doing is correct. But the Bible gives us an unflinchingly realistic view of humanity, that we are a mess. And this is just a good message to all of us here. Don't make heroes of people. Do not make heroes out of people, because every single person on this planet, besides Jesus, is going to let you down. We all fall short. We all fail. We all sin. And if you make a hero out of somebody, whether it be a celebrity or whether it be someone in your life that you look up to, if you make a hero out of them, when that person lets you down, because they will, it'll destroy your faith. It'll ruin your relationship with God, even though God wasn't the one who was faithless. It was just this person who messed up. Abram was a guy. He was a man of flesh and blood. He had a lot of good qualities, but he had a lot of bad qualities too. And what we're looking at in this story is, if you want to put it in modern day terms, you're looking at a marriage crumbling. That's what you're looking at. And we're going to talk about why it's crumbling, and we're going to talk about what God does to save this marriage, because he does save it, which is pretty intense. The first thing that I want to point out is, like I said, you'd think that after Genesis 15, Abram would be so solid with God. He's like, dude, God is so faithful to me that he's willing to die if he isn't faithful to me. Like, that's crazy. How could I possibly doubt in the faithfulness of God now? But he does. He doesn't fully trust God. He doesn't really believe that God's going to come through. He's doubting him. I mean, how do we know that he's doubting him? It goes more than just Abram having sex with Hagar, which is pretty intense. But notice what Sarai says to him. She says in verse 2, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children." So whose fault is this? Who's being blamed? God. Now, did Abram stop her and be like, "Whoa, Sarai, you know, God is faithful, man. Like, look at what he's done in our lives. Look at what he's done in our family, our community. Man, he's given us this land. He's preserved us. He's blessed us. He gave me a promise. He walked down the aisle to demonstrate his faithfulness. How could we possibly say that the Lord is against us in this?" But is that what he says? Is that what he does? No, it actually says, later on in verse 2, it says, "And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai." This doesn't just mean that he listened to what she said, meaning that he obeyed what she said. This means that he listened to her and he believed her reasoning. Okay, so her reasoning behind doing this, she said, "Hey, I can't have kids because God is against me. God's not letting me. So here's my maid. Here's my maid, Abram. You have sex with her. She's going to have a kid, and then I'll raise it as my kid, and that's how we're going to do this from now on." Right, so Abram not only listened to that and said, "That sounds like a good plan, wife," but he also listened to her reasoning. He said, "You know what, you're right. God isn't being faithful. We got to do this ourselves. You know, God's not getting it done. God helps those who help themselves," right? That's somewhere in the Bible. No, it's not. Don't look for that. It's not in there. Right? He's like, "Dude, God helps those who help themselves. I'm going to help myself. We're going to figure this problem out. We're going to raise a family. God's let us down. Let's do it." You know, and that was his plan. That was everything that was going on in his life. Now, we're also going to see, we also see a little bit of the tension between Abram and Sarai and why this marriage is failing to begin with. If you notice, in these passages that we're going to be reading, all we're seeing right now when you read through the Old Testament, all you're seeing is the fall acted out. And that's it. So if you're reading Genesis, you got the prelude, which is the creation of man, the fall of man, and the expulsion from the garden. All the rest of Genesis is just, this is the results of the fall. This is what humanity is like now that we're fallen. And one of the punishments that God gave to Eve, the woman, after they fell, was this. He said, "Your desire will be for your husband, but he should rule over you." That was one of the disciplines that he gave the woman after she fell. Now, what that passage means specifically is it means that now that Adam and Eve, now that man and woman, don't find all their satisfaction and pleasure inside of Christ, one of the disciplines that he gave to the woman is he says, now that you don't find all that you need in me, now you're going to be sorely tempted to find it where? Your desire should be for who? Your husband. Now women and men are tempted to find their validation and their significance in their spouse, or not even in a spouse, it could just be a member of the opposite sex. So I struggle with insecurity, I struggle with how I am as a person, I struggle with loneliness, and where do I find my fulfillment, where do I find my completion? In a woman. A woman struggles with the same thing, you know, am I valuable, am I beautiful, do I have value, do I have significance? I'm going to find it in my husband. And he says the other side of it is, but he should rule over you. Now a lot of people looked at that passage and be like, that's a good thing, you know? Man should rule over woman. That's what's going on. Okay, well, the word that he used for rule there in Hebrew, I'm just going to give you guys a little bit of Hebrew primer here. The word that he used in Hebrew for rule is always used of a dictatorship. So it's not a good ruling. It's not a good ruling. It's a negative ruling. It's someone who is leading out of fear or leading out of anger. Someone who's ruling over, who's dominating another person. You guys understand that? That is the punishment that God gave the man and woman. And that is exactly what they're acting out. Okay, so we see both parts here. First thing that we see is we see the insecurity of Sarah. She says, I don't have any kids. The Lord has restrained me from having kids. Now, we don't really fully understand that in our culture. Because in our culture, we tend to think of the biggest consequence of sex is having kids, right? We're like, dang it, you know. Even when you're married, you're like, man, I don't want to have kids. That's a bad thing. And their culture is very different. Having kids was the most important thing that you could ever do. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? They were a patriarchal society, meaning that all their goods would go to their children. So when you're having kids, what that was evidence of, it was evidence of a continued hierarchy. You're saying like, man, to my son go all of my goods. He's going to take care of my land. He's going to raise up. God's going to use him. Everything's going to happen through my son, and I'm going to bless him forever. And that was their viewpoint of having children. It was not only was it a blessing, but get this, for you ladies, it was a sign of your significance to that culture. A woman who could not have children, and I'll go one step further, a woman who could not have male children was considered useless to her culture. Right? That's pretty harsh, isn't it? We look at that today and be like, man, what a bunch of misogynistic jerks. How dare they, you know, validate women based on whether or not they could have male children. I mean, that's so jacked up. I mean, we would never do something like that in our culture. We're modern Western people. We would never think that way. We would never devalue someone and objectify someone that way. Really? How do women have value in our culture today? Now, if that question may seem a little bizarre to you guys, but let me ask it in a more real way to you guys. Notice how Sarah is reacting. She can't have male children. So how does she feel about herself as a person? She feels like she has no what? No value, no hope. She feels like she has zero significance whatsoever. So much so. I mean, could you guys, you ladies will have to get this. Her validation of herself is so low that she's telling her husband to have sex with another woman. How little of yourself do you have to think that that is a good solution? Right? How low of a validation of yourself do you have to say, like, it would be better if my husband was with another woman? That would be better for him. Because God's holding me back. I'm holding my husband back. I have no value. I have no meaning. I suck. You guys get this? You guys seeing this play out? That's sad. That's incredibly sad. So to put it in modern terms, here's a question I would ask you guys. What today do women feel like they need to have value? Is it kids? And what today, if women don't have this thing, do they feel like they don't have any significance, value, or even a reason to live? Can you guys think of what it is? What's that? Love's a part of it, but it's the means by which you get love. Right? What am I talking about? How about looks? Does that fit? Does that fit what I just said? If a girl lacks looks, does she feel like she doesn't have value? Yeah? Okay? So what happens if a girl feels that she is ugly, how does she view herself? How does she... Low, right? How does she view if she's in a relationship with someone and she feels ugly? Right? How does she feel about her relationship with that person? Does she feel even worthy to be in that relationship? No, right? It's crazy how many females in our society, right? How many girls in our society hurt themselves and cut themselves and starve themselves because of the way they look. So we can look at their culture all we want and judge and be like, these sick people, these sick misogynistic people, but we do the same thing. We've just put it in another category. See, Sarah, you're never going to see a story in the Bible where a girl looks in the mirror and goes like, I'm fat, I need to starve myself, I need to throw up. You're never going to see that happen. Never once does any female in the Bible say like, I need to look better, I need to be pretty, I need to dress differently. They're not worried about what they wear and they're not worried about what they look like because their value didn't come from that. It came from what? Their ability to have children. Their ability to have children. So because Sarai lacks this, she feels like she lacks any significance whatsoever. So that's the first part of the punishment. Do you guys all see this? Okay. Now, how does that look in a marriage today? Okay, so a woman, a wife, feels like she lacks value in a marriage. She feels like she lacks significance in a marriage. And she may take it out a little bit on her husband. Think about your marriage. Maybe you guys have seen this, watched TV, whatever. Okay, so if a female feels as if she's lacking value in the marriage, what is she looking for in her husband? What does she want her husband to do? Give her affirmation and assurance through words and through what else? Comments, and there's other things, right? What other things do you girls look for? Actions, right? Is he spending time with me? Do you take her on dates? Do you? And all the time, it's because she has this insecurity, right? And so the more her husband does these things for her, the more validated that she feels. You understand that? But what happens when the husband stops doing those things? As Art put it, I already live with you. I already said my vows to you. You know, why do I do it? So the husband stops doing these things. What does that make the wife feel like? She's not good enough, right? Why did he stop? Why did he stop? And maybe she'll start thinking things like this. Maybe I'm not as attractive as I was, right? But she usually won't articulate it that way, right? Usually the wife won't say it that way. She won't go to the husband and be like, hey, husband, why aren't you serving me in the ways that we used to? You know, why aren't you pursuing me the way that you used to when we were dating and you were like doing all these amazing romantic things? What happened? She usually doesn't put it that way, right? Usually it turns into something like what Sarah's doing, a passive-aggressive kind of thing, where she's like, dude, the Lord's preventing me from having kids, going to my wife. And what answer do you think she was expecting from her husband when she said that? What do you think she wanted him to say? Couldn't do that. Baby, you're my life, man. Like, how? There is no other girl for me. Man, you're amazing. Are you crazy? But what does he do? Okay. Right? So it might come out that way. She's like, hey, you know, if you don't want to spend time with me, that's okay. Right? And if a woman says something like that, what does she want to hear her husband say? Are you crazy? You're my wife. Of course I want to spend time with you. There's no way. Who else would I spend time with? You're amazing, right? But what does the husband usually say? Okay. Like, oh, you don't want to hang out with me? You don't want to talk? Okay. You know, like, that's, I'm going to go to my man cave. You know, I don't want to bug you, you know? And maybe, and we're going to see this, I'm going to talk about Abraham in a second, the way he's acting. But maybe even in the husband's mind, he's justifying it. Because he's like, well, she doesn't want to hang out with me anyway. I'm doing her a favor, you know, by not spending time with her. And so then you see the cycle, right? So she doesn't feel secure, so she says something like this to get a reaction from the husband. She doesn't get it, so then what happens to her insecurity? It goes up, and then the more it goes up, the more she pushes her husband away, and the more she pushes him away, the further away he goes, the more insecurity goes up. Do you see what's going on here? Do you see what's going on here? Do you see how it works in a marriage? Do you guys have any questions about that? Okay, let's talk about Abraham, because I'm a man and I gotta focus on men and our issues, our probs. Okay, so remember what I said. What was the punishment towards men? What did God say to men? You will rule over her, right? You will rule over her. This is the issue. This is the issue that's with men now. Now, when you have a dictatorship, when you have someone who is ruling over someone, the reason why it's a dictatorship is because of a false sense of superiority. That makes sense. Whenever you have a dictatorship, I like studying history. I've studied a lot of dictatorships, a lot of kings. Usually, and when I say usually, I mean I've never come across a king or a ruler who was like this. The reason why they believe that they're in power is because they think they're better than the people that they're ruling. You understand that? How do we know this? I mean, just look at our culture. Look at the president. Okay, Donald Trump's in presidency. Do you really think he's going to stand up and be like, hey, guys, I'm having a real tough issue. I don't know what to do in this particular foreign policy issue. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to present a vote to you guys. And because I want some help. I want some good counsel. I want to see what you guys, I want to see what the peeps think. You know, I'm going to get a focus group together. You guys talk to me about what you're feeling, what you're thinking, and then I'm going to make a decision from there. Do they do that? Why? Because they think they know better than we do. You guys get that? They think they're better than us. Now, here's the issue with husbands now. Husbands think they know better than their wives. They just assume that they know, but I'm the leader of the relationship. I should know better, right? I should know better than my wife. Duh. Right? That's what good leaders do. They lead, and this is my responsibility. And some husbands have even justified it in their own heads by thinking I'm being a good leader by making the final decision and not listening to my wife. And there's two ways that this could play out. There is the oppressive way, and there is the passive way. Okay, there's the oppressive way and the passive way. This is how it works in a dictatorship. As a dictator, I could either be an oppressive dictator or I could be a hands-off dictator. Both don't bode well for the people. If I'm an oppressive dictator, this is what I think. I think my will is supreme. I think the way I think, I think the way I act, I think that everyone in the country should act the way that I do. And so I'm going to start instituting laws and regulations and things until I make the country the way I think it should be. You guys get that? And I'm just trying to reconform, trying to reconstruct everything into my image of the way I think things should be. And if anyone has a view that's opposing to me, they're the enemy, and I'm going to crush them, and I'm going to demonstrate that my way is the best way. Do we see that happen in politics today? Right? So there's the oppressive way to do it, but then there's the hands-off way to do it. This is the hands-off way to do it. Any of you guys seen The Emperor's New Groove? Great movie. I love it. Right? Cusco's not the oppressive type. Right? He's the emperor of Mesopotamia, right? He's doing his thing. I mean, South America. He's doing his thing. And he is so into himself, he really doesn't care what anyone else thinks. You guys get that? So people are coming to him, and you have in the beginning, right, that guy comes to him, and Yzma's on the throne, and he's explaining how the people in his country are starving to death. And she's like, look, I don't have time to deal with the fact that your people don't have, what was it? And he's like, food. She's like, I don't have time for that. And she just throws him out. And like, she doesn't really care what's going on. And this is the hands-off way. It's, I feel so superior and proud that I really don't care what you do. It's beneath even my notice. Right? And Cusco exemplifies that, right? While his country is struggling, what's he thinking about? His summer home, right? He's like, yeah, I need to build a summer home. I need to evict with a slide. And he's on the Cuscotopia, man. I need to make this thing work for me. And that's what he's thinking about. His people are starving to death, but he's thinking about a water slide. And that's really what's going on in his life. Do we see leaders like that? Right? Only America, right? Yeah. So my needs are so great. They're so much greater than yours that I really don't care what you do. Now, which one is Abraham exemplifying right now? This one, right? Hey, I got my own issues. Do what you got to do, right? That's what he says to her. He says, do what you got to do. In fact, later on, when she starts, it literally says that she starts beating her maid. She starts abusing her. And by the way, her maid is pregnant. She starts abusing a pregnant woman in Abraham's own house. And what does he say? Do with her what you see is fit. Now, he's not saying that out of a genuine concern for his wife, is he? He's saying that. Who's he concerned about when he says that? Himself. I don't want to get in the middle of this. I don't want to deal with this issue. This seems a little difficult for me. Right? And do we see this happening in marriages all the time? Right? The wife's dealing with the kids, and they're all crazy, and they're yelling, and they're screaming, and she goes, why don't you do something? And the husband says, what do you want me to do about it? You know, like, what do you want me to do? I mean, what do you want from me, right? And then do what you see as fit, right? If you want to do it, I'm doing my thing. You do your thing, right? Yeah. I watch a lot of Everybody Loves Raymond. But anyway, you know, that's where I get this from. Yeah, well, what do you want me to, right? Now, is he ruling over her in that instance? He is. He's being a dictator, isn't he? But we don't tend to think of it that way, right? In our modern Western society, we think of that husband as like, man, that guy's a light, you know? He's letting his woman lead. But is he really? No, what's he doing? He's being unconcerned with her problems. He doesn't care about what's going on in her life. He doesn't want to deal with it. Because if I get involved, then I got to think about it. And I got to put off what I'm doing, and I got my job, and I got my friends, and I got to do effort, and I got to think this through, and I got to talk with you about our feelings, you know, and that's going to suck, you know, and why would I do that? And so instead of being the leader that God wants you to be, you're being the oppressive ruler. See, but in our minds, we don't think of it that way, right? We think like, no, you're the oppressive ruler when you're yelling at your wife, And she's saying, I want to do this. And you're like, no, you're not going to do that. And I'm going to, this is why you're not going to do that. And I'm going to, if you do anything, I'm going to, you know, and that's what we think of as an oppressive ruler. But maybe neglect is a far worse ruler than an oppressive one. Maybe the worst thing you could do to someone is not to be oppressive, but maybe the worst thing you could do to someone is be apathetic, uncaring, and unconcerned by the problems. You see how this is also feeding the cycle? Where Sarah's struggling with her value, she's struggling with her worth, she's looking to her husband, and her husband doesn't care. He doesn't care. He can't be bothered. I got my own things going on, right? You know, I don't have time to worry about this. And we also see a little bit of his lust. Now, I'm going to make this argument. I truly believe that one of the reasons why Abram had sex with Hagar is because he wanted to do it, because he was lustful towards her. Right, do we have evidence for that? Is Abram a lustful guy in other parts of Genesis? Yeah. When he dies, it says that Abram actually had concubines. Now, what's a concubine? You guys know what that is? It's a sex slave. So it's like a convenient prostitution, right? Instead of me having to go out and buy a prostitute and worry if she's got an STD, what they would do in this culture is they would raise women to be prostitutes. And you would buy them forever. Does that make sense? So instead of buying a woman for a night, you would buy her forever so you could use her as you will. Abram had some of these. All right, so is this a lustful guy? It's a lustful guy. Okay, so you see another piece of the puzzle of why the marriage is falling apart. Right? Sarah's struggling with her value. She's struggling with her security. What does she see her husband doing? Having sex with other women. Thinking about himself. Not paying attention to her problems. See how it's feeding her? And beyond that, I think there's a good reason why Sarah blames God for the situation that she's in. As a husband, one of the calls for a husband in marriage is to be an example of Christ to your spouse. In Ephesians 5:25, that's what he says. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. So when the wife looks at the husband, she's supposed to see an example of Jesus. She's supposed to see an example of God. And just because you say, well, I'm not going to do that, you know, I don't care, I'm going to live my own life, I'm going to be a terrible guy. You're an example of God no matter what you do. The question is what kind of example of God are you? Are you a good one or are you a crappy one? So Sarah looks at her husband, he doesn't care about her needs. He's only worried about his own stuff. So what kind of God does she think God is? Unconcerned, uncaring, isn't worried about what's going on in my life. I got to figure out my own problems. You see how this is going? Now, this marriage, if people are stubborn enough, this marriage could go on for years, man. This marriage could go on for decades until finally, decades later, these two people hate each other so much, man, that they can't even be in the same room as one another. You know, if you ever want to know, like, where a marriage is going, this is what I, as a marriage counselor, someone who looks at marriages, this is what I look for. Can they keep it together in front of other people? Right? Because when problems like this first start occurring inside of a marriage, they're pretty good at keeping it confined. They're like, we don't want people to know about this. This is embarrassing. But at a certain point, they don't give a rip. They're just like, dude, they'll blow up on each other no matter where they are, no matter who's around. They just do not care, right? They will dish about each other, right? The husband will get with his buddies and be like, you can't believe what I deal with. Come home, my wife's like, you want to have sex with my maid? I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I guess, you know. And now she's complaining and I'm doing this stuff and all I did was what she wanted me to do. I mean, what does she want from me, man? And she's with her girlfriend. She's like, I can't believe him. Man, I'm not getting any attention from him. He doesn't think I'm worthy, you know. And then I tell him, you know, do you want to have sex with Hagar? And he goes, yeah. And now look, you know, and so she's all down. And you see what's going on? You see how this works? Right? Once it gets to that level, when people are just talking about it openly, me as a marriage counselor, I'm like, this is bad. Right? This is bad. This has gone way longer than anyone could have known. This is years in the making going on here. And like I said, it could go, if people are stubborn enough, they will go to death today part, right? But man, it is going to be a hellish ride, right? It is going to cause dissension, and there's going to be sides, and there's going to be splits, and there's going to be separations in the home, out of the home. There's going to be problems all throughout the marriage. But hey, they're going to make it. They're going to make it all the way. Good job, right? You think that honors God? Think God's looking at that marriage like, man, thank you guys for making it. That's what I wanted when I created this wonderful union of man and woman, and I said, this is going to be a picture of my love. I love it when two people just are so angry and spiteful to one another that they just gossip about each other and cut each other down every chance they get, and they're passive aggressive and they bring other people into the argument. This is amazing. Thank you guys for not getting a divorce. Do you think God's happy with that? No. God's not happy with this. He's not happy with what's going on. And he's going to demonstrate to us that he is not happy with what's going on. Let's talk about Hagar real quick. Hagar is really sad. Hagar's story, I feel probably the most sad for her because she becomes a pawn in this game. Right? She doesn't want any part of it. She's this neutral party. She's just working. Does that make sense? She's just like the house cleaner, man. She's just coming over. She's vacuuming stuff. She's hearing them argue in the background. And all of a sudden, Sarah points to her and goes, take my maid. And she's like, what? Like, you know, like this. And he's a 90-year-old guy. She's probably in her 30s. And she's like, I guess I have to, you know, because in that culture, it's not just someone coming over, right? It's literally like you own them. And so it's just so tragic, right? So she's like, okay, I guess I have to. I guess I'm going to do this. She has sex with Abraham. And we see right here, we see the problem. Because people in our culture, we like to believe that you can have sex without consequences. And you can have sex without, you know, getting emotionally involved. And you can have sex without getting physically intimate with somebody. And getting too close and having your emotions hurt. We like to believe that as a culture. But is it true? No. That's one of my major gripes with porn. I have so many gripes with porn, but one of my major gripes with pornography is pornography presents to the world sex without consequences. That if you're a young person and you're viewing pornography, you know what you're seeing? You're seeing people just having sex and there's no consequences. And it's slowly drilling into your head that, like, oh man, I could have sex without consequences. That's what it means. That's why when you read the Bible, you know, Bo usually asked me this question when I first came to him and admitted I have a problem with pornography. One of the questions he asked me is like, does the Bible ever appeal to you? Does it ever attract you in that way? I'd be like, no. And he's like, why not? There's tons of sex in the Bible. I'd be like, what do you mean? Look at this story. There's whole genres of pornography about maid sex, about men having sex with maids. That's like a huge male fantasy. This is presented right here. But nobody reading the story would ever be like, that's appealing. Why? Because it shows the junk that came before it, and it shows the junk that comes out of it. And you look at this, you realize, I don't want this. I don't want this for my life. I don't want all the junk that happens in your heart that would make you do this. It's terrible. I do not want this. But pornography, like I said, it presents a worldview of sex without consequences, and slowly but surely, people in our generation believe it. And we treat our sexuality as though it is not to be special. We treat our sexuality as though it's not to be guarded and protected. And as a result, how are relationships going in our culture? Are they great? Do we have awesome relationships? Man, marriage is great, dude. It's a staple in America. 50% of all marriages end in divorce. At least. 50%. That's a pretty high number for any culture. The marriages that make it. I don't know if anyone's ever done a statistic on the marriages that are terrible that make it. But it would probably be a pretty high number too. Right? So our culture is terrible when it comes to marriage. Because we don't understand this. That's why I love the Bible. The Bible is so realistic. Man, if you want to learn about sexuality, read the Bible. Right? Most holy books, they try to protect you guys from this stuff. They're like, don't think about it. You know, sex is not an issue. Just wait till you're married. Just wait till you're married. Just wait till you're married. But they never tell you guys about the consequences. They never tell you guys about why you should wait till you're married. The Bible does. The Bible says wait till you're married. Why? Because sex has consequences. These are the consequences. This is what could be avoided. This is the correct way of thinking. This is why you should be doing this, this particular way. I mean, just looking at this story, it just stands out stark in our faces of why God says, wait till you're married. Wait till you're married. Wait till you're committed. Because when Hagar has sex with Abraham and she has a kid, she starts thinking, looking at her master, she starts looking at Sarah and being mad at her and angry with her. And you'd be like, why? He's a 90-year-old guy. Why do you care if he's having sex with Sarah? But in her heart, she's like, dude, we had something. We have a kid together. This means something. And he's with this woman who can't even have children. So she's looking for reasons of why Abraham shouldn't be with Sarah. And she's becoming spiteful and vindictive. And then Sarah's beating her. Right? This is what's going on. This is what's happening. Right? Jealousy, enviousness. That's totally a part of our culture. Right? Where, you know, if you ladies, you're dating a guy and you don't feel like he's committed to you. You don't feel like, you know, you're dating him, but he's checking out other girls. Or thinking about, what does that make you feel like? You know, how does that make you feel about how special you are, how unique you are before him? Right? And like I said, pornography is the same way. Right? If I view pornography, what does that say to my wife about how I view her? And the specialness of our marriage. And the sanctity of our intimacy. You guys grabbing this? Right? Our sexuality is supposed to be guarded because it's special. And if you don't agree with that, then just, like I said, just look at the culture. Look at how it's going for our world that we're treating sexuality the way that we are. And ask yourself the question, is like, dude, is that really the way I want to live? When I was coming back to God, this was one of the major issues. This was one of the major things that I realized. I want there to be a God. Because I left God because I thought that the world's way was better. I was like, man, I think that I honestly thought, dude, the church's way is lame. You know, I like sex. I like the idea of sexuality. I like pornography. I like the way that the world looks at these things. This sounds awesome to me. And I was like, dude, I don't like the church. I looked at the church and I looked at all the marriages in the church. A lot of them were falling apart and they seemed really cold and they seemed really passionless. And I was like, I don't want that. I want what the world has. And so I immersed myself in the world, and it only took me till I was 16 to realize I don't want that. I was wrong. You know, this is terrible. This is atrocious. I do not want this. This is tearing me apart on the inside living this way. And so when I came back to God, I didn't want God to look at me and be like, hey, Peter, whatever you do with your sexuality, it doesn't matter. I just love you, bro. I did not want a God like that. I wanted a God who was going to come to me and be like, Peter, you're wrong. This is why you're wrong. This is the right way to live. I wanted a God who was going to correct me. And I praise God that that's the kind of God that I serve. A lot of people our age don't come to God because they don't want God to tell them what to do with their sexuality. Here's the problem. You do it your way, your sexuality is going to be abused and used and violated. It's going to be cheapened. Doesn't mean you're automatically going to end up with a terrible relationship. You might end up with a pretty good one, but these problems will exist. They're going to exist. And the question is, where are you going to go? Where are you going to turn? What's going to help you ladies? Where are you going to turn when you have these insecurities and your husband isn't fulfilling your needs? Where are you going to go? Are you going to go to chick flicks and watch those and be like, I wish my relationship was like that. That'd be great if it was like that. And just lust after that. You're going to go to your girlfriends and just gossip and slander your husband and feel a little bit better about that. Feel a little more empowered that you're able to do that. You're going to become flirtatious with other men. Be like, well, I can't get this kind of attention from my husband, so I'm going to get it from this guy. You know, I'm going to get it from these guys in my life. I'm going to be more flirtatious, more sensual. Try to get it that way. Right? Where are you going to go? Because this problem exists. It's in you. And for me as a man, I need to ask that question too. Where am I going to go? When I feel that need to be oppressive or neglectful towards my wife, where am I going to go? Where am I going to turn? How am I going to fix this issue in my heart? That's there. It's there. It's in me. You can deny it all you want, but it's there. And unless you have a viable solution, it's going to continue to be there. So what's God's solution? Real quick. Genesis 16, verse 7. Now the angel of the Lord found her by the spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way of Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? I love that question. I love how God talks to people in the Old Testament. He always talks to them in questions. It's so great. Right? I mean, God could, like I said, he could easily just come down and be like, Hagar, you're screwing up. This is what you're doing wrong. Let me set you on the right course. Let's fix this. Right? He could have done that. But instead, he asks her questions because he wants her to think. Dude, where are you coming from? He's not just saying geologically, I mean, geographically, you know, like, where are you coming from? You know, east, west, south, you know, where are you from? You know, that's not what he's asking. He's asking, dude, what situation are you coming from? What's going on in your life? Dude, where are you going? You got these problems in your heart, Hagar. You got this insecurity in your heart. You feel dedicated to a man who's married to another woman. Where are you going to go? Right? What are you going to do to fix this problem in your life? And she's like, well, I came from being abused by some chick. But she never answers, where am I going? Because she doesn't know. She doesn't have a solution. So he gives her one. Angel of the Lord, verse 9, said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He will be like a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. He shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me. For she said, have I also here seen him who sees me? Therefore the well was called Be'er Lahai Roi, which means the one who lives and sees me. Observe it, as is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son, whom Hagar bore him, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. A couple things about the story. I'm not going to read 17. You can read on your own time. I'm going to go over it real quick. This is what happens in 17. So this is when God confronts Hagar. And we'll talk a lot about it, because a lot of what we're going to be talking about with Abram and Sarah is going to come out of what happened between Hagar and God. What happens in 17 is God comes to Abram again, and he reinstitutes his covenant with him. He says, I'm going to make a covenant with you, Abram, and you're no longer to become called Abram. He changes his name. The name Abram means exalted father or high father. So you guys, when you're reading in your Bible, be like, why is he Abram here? I've always heard Abraham, right? Father Abraham had many sons, right? You know, that's what I heard. Yeah, the 17 is when God changes his name. Abram means exalted father. Abraham means father of many nations. So God changes his name, and he reinstitutes his covenant with him. He says, dude, I'm going to make you a father of many nations, not just one. And he already said all this in Genesis 15, but now he's giving him a name. He's saying, dude, now I'm gonna give a little piece of faithfulness to you. And in fact, he says, I'm not even going to leave it up to your imagination when I'm going to do this. He says, next year I'm going to do this. I'm going to fulfill my covenant with you. And he says, and Sarai, her name will no longer be Sarai, it will be Sarah. We're like, whoop-de-doo, God. You changed an I to an H. You know, is that your grand solution for Sarah's problem? Is that your grand solution for Abraham's problem? You changed their names? Is that really what you're going to do? Like I said, the way that we understand this is through what God does with Hagar. Because what he does with Hagar, he does specifically with Abraham and with Sarah. Let me explain. So in Hagar's heart, right, God asks her, he asks her, where are you coming from? Meaning, what is the problem in your life? What's the issue in your life? What does she say to him? My mistress is beating me. My mistress is beating me, and I'm in love with her husband. That's what's going on in my life. Right? And God could easily be like, well, here's a solution to that, Hagar. Right? And he could go through it with her. Do you notice he doesn't say anything about her solution to that problem? He doesn't say, hey, Hagar, this is what you should do. In fact, he throws her back in the fire. He goes, hey, you should go back to her and submit yourself to her. And we're like, dude, how cruel is that? God, you're sending her back into the screwed up situation she just left. Right? Shouldn't you tell her to get out of there? Get out of that jacked up family? You know, go start your own family somewhere else. Isn't that what you should say? But instead, this is what God does for her. He says, dude, I will be with you and I will bless you. See what God's solution is? He says, Hagar, your problem isn't that you're mad at your mistress and that you're in love with this man. Your problem is that you're so empty inside, that you're willing to dedicate yourself to some guy who used you. Isn't that sad? I mean, just stop and think about it. She's wanting to be with a dude who's freaking 90 years old, used her like a piece of meat, used her basically as a surrogacy, and it just wants a kid from her, doesn't give a rip about her, allows her to be abused, right? And she's wanting to dedicate herself to that kind of guy. See what God's saying? He said, dude, you know what your problem is? You are so empty. You have so little validation in your life that you're willing to even be in a situation like that and call it good. So his solution to her, I'm going to be your God. I'm going to fill those holes in your life that you feel need to be filled with other people. And that's exactly what he does to Abraham. I mean, it's so cool what he does. The letter that he puts in their name, it's the Hebrew letter of Heth. And it's the letter for breath. Right? So this is what God does. He goes to their name and he puts his breath in the middle of their name. You guys get that? It's almost like, dude, I'm putting my presence in the middle of your name. And just go a little deeper with you guys. Breath in Hebrew is the Hebrew word ruach, from which the word spirit comes from. So God's not just saying, I'm putting my breath in your life. He's saying, I'm putting my spirit in your life. I'm putting my presence right smack dab in the center of your life, and I am going to solve all the problems in your life. And Sarah's name is actually the biggest way we see this. The word Sarai, it means princess from birth. All right, so this is what it means. It means that you're a princess because either A, you're married to someone who is of royal descent, or B, you come from a family of royal descent. Sarah is a name that means princess by your own merit. You guys see the difference? So Sarai is, I'm a princess because my dad's king or because my husband's king. Sarah is, I'm princess because I'm princess. Right? That's why. Here's what God's saying. You're trying to find your validation through who? Your husband. That's why you were a princess before, because your husband was royal. I'm going to make you royal by your own merit. You're royal because I know you. Because I'm going to make you valuable. Because I'm going to live in your life. In the New Testament, when Jesus, after Jesus rises from the dead, he comes to his disciples and it says that he breathes on them. He breathes on them. We're like, what? Like, that's kind of weird. But you see what he's doing? He says, receive the Holy Spirit. See, when we come to Jesus, when we put our faith in, we get salvation and all that. But more importantly than that, we get his presence, which is what we so desperately need. And his presence in my life as a husband, he gives me to the ability where I no longer am so concerned with myself that I'm just going to be selfish and I'm going to allow my wife's actions to make me angry and become bitter at her and to feel passive aggressive and feel the need to rule over her because I feel so insecure about my life and myself that I need to rule over someone else. But he gets me to the place where now I'm so validated and secure that I can love my wife and care about where she's at and want to guard my sexuality for the sake of Christ, not just for my marriage. And my wife could say, man, like God has filled my life in such an amazing way, and he has made me so royal and so beautiful that I don't need to seek it in a man anymore. And now that I am that validated, now I am freed up to love instead of become bitter and resentful and seek my treasure in every other avenue except for the true and living God. Right? Do you guys get that? That's what fixes their marriage. It's not God bringing them through a book. It's not God sitting down and be like, you guys are jacked. Let's go into, you know, Freudian psychology and I'm going to get to the issues that are going on in your lives. Hey, that stuff needs to happen. But unless God becomes the solution for all the problems in your life, it's not a solution at all. It's definitely not an eternal one. Right, God needs to give us a new name. God needs to give us a new identity. That's what needs to happen inside of our lives. That's what's going to heal us. And real quickly, just so you guys see that this is Jesus that's speaking here. Notice it says the angel of the Lord is talking to her. It doesn't say the Lord. It says the angel of the Lord. In Hebrew, the word angel just means messenger. Messenger of the Lord. And sometimes the messenger of the Lord is an angelic winged, I guess they have wings sometimes, creature, you know, going to people. But sometimes the angel of the Lord does weird things in the Old Testament. The angel of the Lord seems to claim to be God. And this is one of those instances. He says, I'm the angel of the Lord. But notice when Hagar sees him, she says, dude, you're the God who sees me. She doesn't say, you're just some angel. She says, you're God. You see me and I've seen you. Which is pretty radical. The angel of the Lord is the means by which God has a relationship with people in the Old Testament. Jesus is the means by which we have a relationship with God in the New Testament. He is the very presence of God in our lives. Right? So through studying the cross, through studying the life of Jesus, that is how we're healed. That is how we have a relationship with the true and living God. And that's what benefits us. Okay, let's pray, and then we'll do one last song of praise. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word. And I pray that we would learn from these tough examples, God, to not take these matters trivially, but to really think through them in our own lives. And to seek you to fill us in the ways that we've tried to find in the world. Lord, help us to be complete in you. Help us to love you, and help us to know you. And in your name, amen.